Welcome back to episode 331. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, and I wish I was in Germany, where the entire country seemingly is protesting in the middle of winter attempts by the government, so-called, in Germany to basically defood the nation. This is, their interpretation of the green policies, that World Economic Forum and others are promoting. Anyway, the point is the whole nation, 70% support for this strike, and it seems to be gaining momentum. And I just wanted to say that there is no news coverage here in the U.S. of this important event. And so anyone who listens to us, I would hope, who has the capacity, would just promote the strike and support it, because this could be something, very, very seminal to the future. God bless the Germans at this point.
Yeah, why would, political instability and mass protests in the most important nation in the heart of Europe gather the attention of any Americans or the American
press? Yeah, why would that be important? Zero media coverage of it here in California, not a single word.
So again, that happens if there's a mass protest in a major country in Europe and it does not report it by the mainstream media, does it happen? I think what I read of the protest, this is largely driven by farmers, and again, large vehicles are being used to intimidate politicians. That seems to be a standard approach, stemming from high energy prices, which then, of course, this is a result of the Anglo-American Zio war in the Ukraine that they fomented in 2022. And of course, the destruction of the Nord Stream, at least one of the Nord Stream pipelines, which is leading to energy shortages in Germany. Am I correct with that?
Exactly right. I mean, this is a combination of very high energy prices with inexplicably kind of created increases in taxation on farms and their operation, and an inexplicable amount. Well, this is not inexplicable because it's all part of their green policy, but an increase in regulations. So everything is a just altogether perfect storm for German farm production, and the farmers can see the handwriting on the wall. Their businesses are going to be destroyed. Moreover, the country is going to starve to death. So they're protesting, and the goal is removal of the government.
Yeah, you need physical removal of people.
Yeah, for sure.
And possibly more.
Where does it become self-defense?
What's the penalty of treason?
This is really how serious the situation is. The German government is basically genociding the German people.
Yeah, they haven't had a sovereign government since May 6th or 7th, or May 7th or 8th, 1945.
Well, I mean, go back further as far as I'm concerned. It's been a long time since Germany was,
They don't have a functioning constitution.
No.
And so, it's an occupied government. But the thing is, I think this is green policies is implementation of what's referred to, at least by some Germans, which shows some awareness of at least some continuity of understanding of this issue. They're calling it Morgenthau 2.0.
And that's exactly correct. This is Morgenthau 2.0. This is just depopulation of Germany. There's no plan to transition from the current, farming system to one that, equates with the new regulation, which produces enough calories to keep the nation in existence. So
At the end of the day, you have to have enough calories to live, right?
Yeah, you do at some point.
I think the Israelis understand that too, how they're treating the in Gaza. They don't allow enough calories for a long-term survival in Gaza. So
right. So that's then they can sit back and say, well, God is working his magic. I mean, humans always have rationale for evil. They have to, because otherwise, they can't just tell the truth at saying, well, I just want to hurt these people, kill them, starve them. Mm-hmm. So they always have the pretext. And to make the world better, the public just needs to become more expert at seeing through the pretext and seeing to what is really in back of all this, which would really be useful in understanding Americans' foreign policy historically, which is virtually always, there's a pretext for the activity. It seems like our foreign policy, you know, I was like thinking about like Iraq, the current situation in Iraq, which is another Afghanistan. You know, they're really, you can see, you know, that they're just going to walk away from this, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to have all this carnage, nation will be destroyed, you know, people just shattered. And at the end of the day, nothing was achieved really other than the carnage. And we just walk away. So what was in back of the foreign policy? I mean, you have Saddam Hussein, certainly someone that you would think could have been reasoned with or somehow, you know, controlled in a way other than just destroying the nation. But going back to the pretext, had we just told, you know, the Iraqi people and the American people that this is really where we're going, that the current situation in Iraq, that's the goal, that's really what we want, no one would have supported it. No one, they would have said, well, wait a second, why all these millions of people displaced and killed for no particular gain in terms of, you know, stability in the region? What is the purpose of all this? And so it just brings up the question as to who controls our foreign policy, right? I mean, what is actually in back of, you know, the Vietnam War, Afghanistan, Iraq, the current support for Israel in terms of the situation in Gaza, you know, the destruction. I mean, you could just go down the list. I mean, Libya, you know, what was that foreign policy for? And then going even further back, then you have like World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War. What is really, you know, kind of the animating principle of our foreign policy? Or is there one?
Yeah, it's kind of it's apparently the policy has been hijacked, but it begs the question, or at least it creates the question: has the U.S. government ever had a genuine American first foreign policy, or has it always been the tool of, you know, cosmopolitan oligarchs? I think there was a time when America wasn't a consolidated nation state; it was still a federation or a confederation of largely sovereign states, a very small, relatively small federal government. That you could say that's sort of in America's innocent age, and so if there its policies or its pursuit abroad of control, of keeping trade routes safe, all these pretexts of expanding or extending democracy to the benighted peoples of the world wasn't there yet. And there was the age of continentalism. Of course, from the standpoint of the Plains Indians, America regime might not have come across as innocent, but of course the Indians weren't innocent themselves. Get into that debate, but this one of these things where is when did America ever have a has ever America ever had a foreign policy that represent the interest of the American people? Can a country or a nation state like America have a genuine American foreign policy? Because the United States for the longest time has sort of just been a network of various interests, often foreign interests if they've infiltrated the country. And that's sort of a nature of America being a nation of so-called immigrants, right? That's what we're told. And of course, as it became that, foreign policy became more complicated as certain ethnic groups became much more powerful, and they were able to inveigle themselves and take over the organs of state and media and these things. We can talk about that. This question came to mind because I just saw that this week. there's a headline that U.S. bombs Houthis.
Yeah,
I think there is a it was Ambrose Bierce who said that war is God's way of teaching Americans geography. I suspect that the vast majority of Americans would ask, who are the Houthis? They might think it's a character and like in a Star Wars, one of the Star Wars prequels or sequels, whatever. Who are the Houthis? Well, the Houthis is a group of in Yemen that apparently controls as much as 60% of the country, although it's not the official government. It's not the government that's recognized by the U.S. or the Saudi or the Saudis. There's been a 10-year civil war in Yemen. It was unified after the Cold War. It used to be North Yemen and South Yemen. It was unified. But the Saudis have been waging a vicious war, trying to use mercenaries, I think largely Pakistanis, who simply don't want to fight for obvious reasons on the ground. So there's been an air war in Yemen for about 10 years, supported by the United States, very savage, also an embargo, which is causing mass starvation, another crime that's not being largely reported in the United States, policy supported by the United States. But the Houthis apparently have threatened or have been attacking or harassing container vessels, ships. And this is a choke point for foreign trade, international commerce. It feeds into the Suez Canal. So there's a choke point there where they can send these little drones that cost thousands of dollars to bother the ships. Now, you don't have to sink a container ship. You just have to bother it, and it causes the insurance rates to skyrocket, which then makes trade in those areas or commerce in that area not economical. They have to switch the routes going around the Horn of Africa, which makes it much more expensive. Insurance rates will triple, quadruple, and whatever. And so they understand this. Now, the reason why the Houthis are doing this is because they claim to have solidarity with the Gazans, who are being ethnically cleansed from Gaza and by the Israelis. This is a result, sort of a consequence of the Israeli war on Gaza. Again, the Israelis continue to bomb and kill thousands of mostly unarmed Gazan civilians, supposedly in response to the October 7th raid, which occurred, I think, one day. It was a 24-hour period. They're using it as a pretext to ethnically cleanse the area. And of course, the United States government is complicit. It condones it and is complicit in it because it is supplying billions of dollars in aid and weaponry to help Israeli prosecute this brutal ethnic cleansing campaign in Gaza. And also the West Bank, the Israelis have also used the war as pretext to carry out assassinations in Iraq. They've carried out bombing raids in Lebanon to go after Hezbollah. So the war is expanding. Now we have the U.S. retaliating to the Houthis attacking the shipping, and then they're sending Tomahawk missiles into Yemen. I don't know what they're hitting. I think Tomahawk missiles cost hundreds of thousands of dollars a piece. Are they hitting anything? This is classical asymmetrical warfare, where the Houthis can just cause a lot of trouble at a very low cost. Of course, the solution would be to negotiate a peace in Gaza, ceasefire. I think the Houthis have placed, they said they would stop harassing the shipping if the Israelis lifted the embargo and allowed humanitarian aid to get through and feed the help the Gazan people, the people in Gaza. The Israelis are refusing to do that. And then, of course, the way it's being treated in the press is that the Houthis, just for no reason at all of a sudden decided to attack shipping. So now the U.S. is claiming that it's providing the historical role of keeping the shipping lanes free for commerce. It's, I think, Prosperity Guard. The operation was Prosperity, not Guard, what was it? Prosperity Guard or something, whatever. Guardian, Prosperity Guardian. So, but then that's not putting in the context, because this is a response to the Israeli ethnic cleansing operation in Gaza. But instead of, I was watching the news reports on Fox and CNN. They're all talking about Houthis and the shipping and the war there, but no one talks about the war in Gaza. And the Houthis' terms are, "We'll stop doing this if you stop killing the Gazans." The Palestinians in Gaza. Instead, they're saying that Houthis provide, or at least get some logistical support, weaponry, as also intelligence from Iran. And neoconservatives are going to use it as a pretext to expand the war on press, create a pretext to have a war against Iran. So this is a classical escalation you see here. It's ridiculous, of course, because the obvious solution is to simply put pressure on the Israelis to stop ethnically cleansing and genociding those in Gaza and come to some sort of terms with those in Palestine. But they're not willing to do that because they control U.S. foreign policy. Guess my big question is, when was U.S. foreign policy hijacked? It's been hijacked. We can say it's sort of been taken over by, or it's always been manipulated by other forces, financial, cosmopolitan foreign forces. We can go as far back as perhaps the Spanish-American War, but there are elements even in the age of continentalism. American expansion in the continent was encouraged. This was a doctrine of manifest destiny, which was a slogan created by August Belmont. His real name was Schoenberg, who was a Rothschild agent. Even the so-called American Civil War was fomented or coaxed by foreign interests, particularly the European bankers, who some say sought to divide the United States to exploit the legitimate grievances that perhaps the South had to create a war of separation, to break up the United States. At the same time, they could loan the money to the North, to the federal government to prevent secession. But Lincoln turned down that offer. I think they offered 40% interest on loans, and Lincoln decided to go the greenback route and not borrow money. He printed money, and that might have factored into his eventual assassination in April 1865. So there's always been intriguing in this country. The idea of American foreign policy, American relation to the rest of the world, supposedly was clarified by George Washington, of course, our first president, in his farewell address, when he said, "It is our true policy to steer clear of permanent alliances with any portion of the foreign world." That was his farewell address in 1796. Thomas Jefferson had a similar approach. He was, of course, the third president of the United States, and he stated that he spoke of peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. We've come a long way since then, haven't we? Nevertheless, when he was president, he was confronted with a crisis in the Mediterranean. This was the Barbary pirates. And in 1801, almost immediately after him taking office, he did order a squadron, to go out and attack and blockade Tripoli, where the pirates were operating. They were engaged. They were preying on shipping and also enslaving Americans, imprisoning and holding them for ransom. So immediately America was drawn into some foreign conflict, but nevertheless, you could see, you could construe from that or infer some genuine American interest in that. The original, I guess, the classic understanding of American non-interventionism or isolationism, if you will, that's always, I think, a pejorative term. It misrepresents the approach, but we can talk about that. Interventionism as opposed to isolationism. John Quincy Adams president in the 1820s, I think 1825 to 1829, and he laid out the philosophy of America's foreign policy. And it's basically, I'll just use his words: "Wherever the standard of freedom and independence has been or shall be unfurled, there will be our heart, our benedictions, her prayers be. But she goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She's the champion and vindicator of her own. She will commend the general cause by the countenance of her voice and the benignant sympathy of our example." This is 19th century speak, so this is difficult. So she knows that by once enlisting under our other banners than her own, were they even the banners of a foreign independence, she would involve herself beyond the powers of extrication. And in all the wars of interest and intrigue, of individual avarice, envy, and ambition, which assume the colors and usurp the standard of freedom, the fundamental maxims of her policy would be insensibly changed from liberty to force. She might become the dictatress of the world. She would be no longer the ruler of her own spirit. And that pretty much sums up the state of American foreign policy today. I think John Quincy Adams was accurate as assessment. If we do get involved in the intrigues of foreign nations, let foreign interests and foreign lobbies come in and suborn and take over our government, we lose our own independence. So you can see that today, as America condones and finances a brutal war in Gaza, the United States fomented a war in Ukraine. And at the same time, it's doing this, and then seem to be expanding the war in the Middle East with the Yemen, and then there are elements that are saying we should bomb Iran. At the same time, when our borders aren't even protected, millions of foreigners are swarming into the country. The government is allowing this, so this is, again, we do not have a sovereign government, because we don't have a government which pursues the interest of the American people anymore. So that's the state of American foreign policy today. It's probably, we can talk about, if you wanted to get into some, the foreign wars, like Spanish-American War, World War One, World War Two, what interest those served. 1898, America sought to supplant the Spanish Empire in the Caribbean and in the Pacific. It took the Philippines. This one, they had American Samoa. It obviously took Cuba. Hawaii was seized in 1894 and was annexed, I think, just after the Spanish-American War. So that's when America became an empire. It was involved, I think it was involved in Asia and China. It supported the European powers in the Boxer Rebellion. So it had all these early imperial adventures. You could infer from that there were Americans doing that, but even early on, there were foreign interests that I alluded to. 1898, you talk about America was trying to supplant or push out the Spanish Empire, which is thought of, which many wrote of as being medieval and primitive. It was Catholic, and it was being ruled by a Protestant power. I would argue that America is a Protestant nation, is a liberal nation, capitalist, is a vulnerable nation for subversion. And I think a Jewish power found the American system congenial, or at least easy to infiltrate and take over, as we see in the 20th century. Even those early wars, it becomes more apparent in World War One or World War Two. We can talk about Korea and Vietnam is more of a that's more of a WASP lead adventure. Although you could see something in Vietnam. We could talk about that. Obviously, the Cold War, and this was, of course, is after the Stalin Trotsky split, and the neoconservative Trotskyites became cold warriors, particularly in the 1970s. And then, of course, the end of the Cold War, you do have the ascendancy of Jewish power and the rise of the neoconservatives and the takeover of US foreign policy, where we are today. Now, that is a broad, I guess, overlook or review of 150 years of American foreign policy. So I'll let you kick in here.
Okay. I would say American foreign policy has to be looked at through the lens of a hidden Freemason control over our government. I mean, I would say that's the first step. Freemasonry is, an organization that was set up under mysterious conditions. We can go into the origins of it at a certain point here, but let's just accept it as an organization that is hidden and affecting our government. In
Well,
fact,
isn't I'm sorry, I'm interrupting. I know we're talking about it. America itself is largely an Enlightenment Freemasonic project.
yeah, it's not I wouldn't say enlightened, but it is a Freemasonic project.
Its ideas are, you see it implemented in the con, I mean, look at Washington, D.C., for that matter. I'm
For
sure.
sure. And I mean, unfortunately, these words mean one thing to the general public, but I think they mean something else to the controlling units inside of Freemasonry. Like the expression "In God We Trust," which is so common throughout our political documents, and it is also common inside of the Freemasonry oath system. I think it just means different things to different people, so you have to be very careful what the words mean. But I would just, we talked about how foreign policy needs to be scrutinized from the perspective of just veiled depopulation. I mean, let's start with the American Revolution. I mean, it's completely Masonic on the U.S. side of the equation. The Dragon Lodge in Boston, was creating the Tea Party. All of the majority of the founding fathers are either overt Freemasons or over half of them are overt, and then there of the others, there are certain of them are suspected, like Jefferson. So it's basically controlled by the Masons on the U.S. side of the war. On the other side, the British royal family is, of course, 100% Masonic. You can go to the Brighton Pavilion to see the palace that I think it was either the son or the father of the king who was in charge of Britain during the Civil War, during the Revolutionary War. And the entire edifice is covered with Masonic symbolism, just overt Masonic symbolism. I mean, this is someone who is a Freemason extraordinaire and in the extreme, right? So the question is, well, why couldn't these Lodge brothers have worked it out? And I would just suggest that the war was arranged, certainly in part, to create kind of a political power for Masons inside of the United States and to depopulate sections of personalities that they didn't control. Now, there was, I think, other elements inside of the war, but that is the hidden element that isn't really given a lot of scrutiny, and I think needs to be, because I believe that if you go forward in our foreign policy, so-called, in terms of the wars, this very often comes up as something which seems to be this kind of hidden hand, to use an expression, in back of the insertion of the U.S. into war. And I would just suggest World War One is probably the easiest to understand. I mean, it's a Masonic project on both sides of the conflict. Certainly Germany and Britain, these are Masonic elements that are being, you know, controlling the population, and then are ramming the population in with no political purpose that can be, you know, articulated, and depopulation occurs. So I just think that that is the template that you need to first look at all of the conflicts with, is that are they being created with a pretext of, you know, saving democracy, you know, whatever the explanation is. But underneath this is, in fact, you know, one would need to analyze it for Masonic control for the purpose of depopulation of sections of of peoples that they want to control. So, you know, you get to our current situation, like the one that the two that are immediate, you know, both the Gaza war and the Ukraine. I think this is the template that these conflicts can be best understood with. You know, I mean, I think that you have a very weak pretext for the actual war in Gaza. The October 7th attack is not well understood. There's not a lot of scrutiny to whether or not it was a false flag. The Israeli response is completely inappropriate, and under any circumstance. And what the interpretive framework that makes sense is that this is just depopulation of the Palestinians from Eretz Israel, which is a, you know, I think obvious kind of way of looking at this thing. The Ukraine, I don't really understand the war coherently in any other way, right? I mean, you're certainly not helping the Ukrainian people with this process. They're being genocided. And so again, you have foreign policy that has a hidden hand, and the purpose of the war is depopulation. So when you get to like the certain things with the Houthis, I would just point to Lawrence of Arabia's letter, in which he described why the Sykes-Picot agreement was such a useful thing. And he said it's because this will create small fractional and antagonistic elements, which will easily be manipulated into warfare with one another, mm-hmm. right? So he said, this is going to be a very simple thing for us to do. If we set up the pan-Arabic, you know, world between Iraq and the Red Sea, In this kind of unorganized, small, fractional, you know, kind of things, and so then you can easily manipulate them. You don't have one coherent political leadership which might actually create some benefit to the Arab populations, and so, you know, from the very beginning of our, you know, the creation of the current foreign policy in the Middle East, which is to say the creation of the Israeli state, there has been a hidden hand which has been there to support and promote Israel's strength and nationhood at the expense of all of what was could be called Arabia. And remember that, you know, we've talked about this many times, that the actual agreement between Hussein and McMahon was to have a unified, independent Arab state. That was the agreement. Upon that, the Arabs fought with the British against the Ottomans. They took 100,000 fatalities, 500,000 casualties. They paid the blood price. And at the end of the day, it all got stolen from them. And fortunately, in this instance, we have the letter, which I think is just incredibly important and illustrated, Tim, of this whole hidden hand business to our foreign policy, because this, I think, is really illustrative of what goes on in the control of our foreign policy. McMahon's letter, and he said that, you know, I don't take the idea of a future strong, united, independent Arab state seriously. The situation and elements are too nebulous for that. What we have to arrive at now is to tempt the Arab people into the right path, detach them from the enemy, the Ottomans, and bring them to our side. This on our part at present is simply a matter of words. And to succeed, we must use persuasive terms and abstain from academic haggling over conditions. Now, so what he's saying is we're just going to lie, get them to fight for us, and then just rearrange the nation, the area in any way we want. This idea about a really coherent Arab state, no, that's not going to happen. And so now at the end of all of this, you have the Houthis, bombing or sending rockets against, ships that containing oil, the chaos that's being created. And it's just this long-standing kind of self-destructive chaos that these fractional groups inside the Arab world have been manipulated into being part of, you know? And so when you look at our foreign policy, it is the creation of outright depopulation, the conditions of political impotence, right? Not just because in the case of the Houthis, you know, and the whole Arab world, they've been fractionalized and set upon one another. I mean, there are hundreds of examples of how that has been manipulated. And it's all for the purpose of keeping this region in a state that can be controlled and then ultimately completely depopulated. So that's what we're looking at with our foreign policy, is a Masonic project for first control and then genocide.
Well, one thing, it's never been popular, but the end was
popular.
But yet the American people have no say in the formulation of their foreign policy, and they're manipulated by the media, which is controlled by the same powers that are controlling foreign policy. And this has been true at least since the second decade of the 20th century, with the America's intervention into the Great War, the First World War. And then that's the first time you can actually identify real interests, like whether it's Wall Street, JP Morgan, the financial interests that were tied to London, but also the Jewish Jewish power coming of age with the Balfour Declaration. But it's never been popular. Very popular anti-war movements. There was sort of the Anti-Imperialist League, which was accused of being anti-Semitic, which is interesting. And that's the first decade of the 20th century. They opposed the America's, foray in the empire in the Spanish-American War. Then there was the America First Committee, which formed in the late 19th or 1939 in response to the Roosevelt administration's attempt to involve America into the European war raging, which again had been manipulated or fomented by perfidious Albion, particularly disputes regarding the German-Polish border, Czechoslovakia, and these things. Turning a border dispute into a general conflagration, a general war in Europe. None of these things were popular. But then we had this term isolationism come about. Of course, isolationism, I think, it might have been coined in the 1920s in response to people's, unhappiness with the results of America's involvement in the First World War. It was supposed to be to make the world safe for democracy. There was a lot of bitterness as a consequence of the cost of that war, all the carnage. But it became a term of a disparagement in response to America First Committee, which had boasted 850,000 dues-paying members. Charles Lindbergh was a very popular speaker, but all of a sudden he became the devil. The media turned on him. The hero, the aviator, the famed aviator, became a public company number one because the media, which is controlled even then, controlled by the Jewish lobby as it existed then, because of his efforts against the Roosevelt administration's drive to war. But again, isolationism. Well, those of basically that's a term. Again, I said it's a term of disparagement. It misrepresents the position. Basically, if you're against all the foreign wars, whether it's American intervention to Haiti, seizing the Philippines, intervention of into the European War in 1917, intervention into the European War in 1941, 42, the Korean War, Vietnam War, all the interventions since then, Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, all the disasters that these interventions created, they call you an isolationist. Well, the real term is a non-interventionist, meaning that you should just not intervene in these things, not meddle. Of course, this doesn't take into account the fact the role of US-backed intrigues in fomenting these crises to begin with. There's a lot more; these situations are much more complex than the media portrays them to portrays them. But if you have doubts about, say, America's role in NATO, you're not a non-interventionist. You're not following George Washington's prescriptions. You're an isolationist. So if you are against the Vietnam War and America bombing, peasant Vietnamese peasants, spraying Agent Orange and carpet bombing these areas, you're not a non-interventionist. You're not a humanitarian. You're an isolationist, right? If you're against America intervening in Somalia, you're against America invading Afghanistan, Iraq, 2003. They would say, wait a second, you're forgetting the lessons of Munich. This is appeasement, right? This is the point of narrative. You're not a non-interventionist. You are an isolationist, which is ridiculous because simply not engaging in foreign wars or fomenting foreign wars or constantly meddling in other countries' affairs, seeking to dominate the planet, doesn't make you an isolationist. It makes you a non-interventionist. It also makes you sane. But apparently, foreign policy is now dominated by people who are certifiably insane. And so this is where we are. I mean, it's again, it's always been popular. In 1964, Lyndon Johnson campaigned on a platform of peace against interventionism, and he won overwhelmingly, defeated Barry Goldwater. There was a joke at the time, because Barry Goldwater was the hawk in regards to Vietnam, and there was a joke at the time that said they said if I voted for Barry Goldwater, we'd be at war within a year. And I voted for Barry Goldwater. And yes, we were at war within a year.
Well,
Woodrow
don't forget.
Wilson campaigned in 1916. He kept us out of war. Franklin Roosevelt campaigned in 1940 for his third term, saying he that mothers, your sons will not be fighting any foreign wars anymore. They all campaigned in 1952. Dwight Eisenhower promised to go to Korea and seal a peace. In 1968, Nixon claimed he had a secret plan for peace in Vietnam. And in 2000, George W. Bush campaigned as against America being a policeman for the world. And then 2000s, more recent 2016, Donald Trump campaigned on an explicitly America First policy, non-interventionist policy. These things win elections, but nevertheless, despite all this, even Barack Obama 2008 could be construed as a non-interventionist. They were tired of all the warmongering and baying for war that occurred during Bush 2 administration. It could be construed as a non-interventionist peace platform, as wrong as the public was. Nevertheless, American people vote for this, and guess what happens? They don't get it. So obviously, there's, as you say, there are secret agents, if you will, a secret government, a deep state. A secret society, if you will, that is controlling U.S. foreign policy. Now, I don't even call it a secret society because it's so obvious now, because the Freemasons, the WASP, if you will, have been supplanted by the Jews. Now we have a policy that is dominated by the Israeli lobby, which is obvious now. It's pretty obvious now, and this is also bleeding into domestic affairs, where now a few Jewish billionaire donors are shutting down free speech on college campuses, getting college president, university presidents fired, and imposing a censorship on the country because their beloved Israel apparently is beleaguered, but it's not. It's actually fighting an offensive war. It's just collecting enemies one after another because what they're doing is so disgusting and repulsive, you know. So there, that's where we are.
Yeah, you know, and I would point out that when we say, you know, that Jewish interests are in the ascendancy and like manipulating from behind the scenes, we have to always remember that what we see today as Jews is in fact a Freemason project. You know, in the middle part of the 19th century, Reform Judaism, which was by far the most popular form of Judaism, was completely anti-Zionist. When Palmerston made his declaration in 1840 that now is the time for the Jews to return to the homeland, they just couldn't understand what the heck this guy was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They had to destroy Reform Judaism, which they did with Rothschild money and hiring people to go out to the different congregations and steadily put in administrators in the same way they took over like medical universities in the United States to make sure that their people were in place so that Zionism or Zionistic Judaism would be, you know, the dominant form of the religion. And then they swept the Jewish people in who had been opposed to Zionism. They swept them up into this catastrophic foreign, you know, policy concept over, you know, decades and decades of basically propaganda, so that when you get to the modern Zionistic Jew, you really have, in my opinion, just a completely polished and finished Freemasonic project. And, you know, the question is, well, why did the Freemasons do this? Which then asks the question, well, who are the Masons? You know, it seems to me like you have a secret society that's very ancient and seems to be related to, you know, the form of Judaism that was fighting in the first century against Rome. But it's probably something that is kept very hidden from like your everyday Jew on the street who's just, you know, manipulated by the propaganda to supporting Israel and to seeing themselves as belonging to a people that never attacks and is only the victim of crime after crime. You know,
yeah. Well, they're indoctrinated in that. Yeah.
Yeah, they're just completely indoctrinated. Yeah. So it all kind of ends up in the same place. But
then they're encouraged to behave in a way that make people resent them.
Yeah. And to have this explanation, like the really bizarre irrationality of Jews in America to the Gaza genocide. They you know, just are kind of hair triggered to the idea that we were attacked once again and our response can be, Samson, we can just go out and just kill everybody.
It's just overwrought. I mean, did you see that thing? There's Jewish students are suing Harvard for anti-Semitism.
I did see that. Yeah.
They're overrepresented at Harvard by 1,000%. And
sure.
If you look at it, I think Ron Unz did a study on this and there's the myth of American meritocracy about this. And he's, if you control just for academic records, the Jewish population would be halved at Harvard. Of course, you also at the same time, you've had the administration that is disproportionately Jewish. And many presidents, of course, the current president, the interim president of Harvard is Jewish. Again, and for them to come out and claim that Harvard and even the other Ivy League schools are anti-Semitic is on its face absurd. But nevertheless, they make that claim. If anything, it's philo-Semitic. They've twisted and manipulated the system actually to increase the presence of Jews on campus, not just in the student body, but on the administration itself. And now to the point where Harvard obviously now is Jewish controlled. We see that now with the expulsion of the, you know, their golem, you know, Clyde Gay, who just simply wasn't sufficiently enthusiastic towards Zionism. And she gave lip service to free speech, you know. So it's just absurd it is how they're going to claim that anti-Semitism is a problem on college campuses. And what they saw called anti-Semitism is simply protesting to the savage response by Israel and Gaza. And then not just this recent thing, but we're talking, you know, six decades of this stuff going on, you know, and the, or seven, going back to 1948. And then you have idiots like, what's your name? You know, she's running for president, South Carolina governor. Nikki Haley.
Yeah.
Nikki Haley claims that America, Israel doesn't need America. America needs Israel.
You know, do you
So
think
why do I? So
you
how
know
did America survive until 1948 without Israel?
I mean, is Nikki Haley as really as stupid as she seems? Because I just can't believe that. I think she has to be some kind of,
She's just paid to say that.
sophisticated agent or someone who's just completely controlled, who has, is being paid like an actor to just make stupid statements, just because she doesn't come across to me as being dumb enough to actually make the comments that she does.
Well, if that were true, if America is indeed a burden on Israel, then we should sever all ties to her, let Israel free to defend itself.
Yeah,
Follow
that
her
would work.
logic, right?
Yeah.
So is Israeli defending the United States? It's like, wait a second. Sorry, is Israel giving basically interest-free, non-payable loans to the United States? Is
Yeah,
Israel sending weaponry to our border to defend our border?
you can see the old Masonic control, the hidden hand. It becomes visible from time to time. I think now, you've had so much distribution of the power that they have, it's harder to see, and they brought Jews into positions of authority over and over again. So it's really the hidden hand is hard to see, but it does appear from time to time. And one of the places that is the most clear is when you have these like purportedly Christian politicians like Christie or Romney, and they talk about Israel, and they go into a kind of ecstatic
Yes.
trance, where they're just they lose all sense of self and reason, and they just see Israel as the one and only thing in the universe that needs support and has to be defended. Everything, all other nuance is gone.
Yeah, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, actually said that should Washington burn to the ground, our support for Israel would still persist.
Yeah, exactly. So you see, that's
What?
when you see those purported Christians make those statements, and you look at them and you go, well, this is just inexplicable. Why in the world would they have such an extreme and an irrational, unnuanced view of the world? Well, the explanation would be that they're reflecting the old hidden hand, that these people are probably conversos of one form or another, that have some kind of controlled allegiance to not to Israel so per se, but to the secret society that produced Israel. That's really what's manipulating them. I think actually, because it's interesting, because I do a podcast in Israel from time to time, and just what I can gather talking to this person and a few others, I think the secret society could care less about the Jews in Israel. They're just like a window dressing to their big, world controlling plans. I think that they would sacrifice them. For example, the question is was the attack on October 7th, were any of the fatalities, the Jewish fatalities, real? If it's a false flag, would they actually sacrifice,
Well, the Hannibal Directive suggests that most of the casualties reported were caused by Israeli friendly, so-called friendly
for
fire.
example? Yeah. So, but my point is that I think that even though the Jews think they have this privileged status in the New World Order, it is they really should think a little more deeply about this, because I think that they will be sacrificed just like anyone else would be to the secret society that runs things. You know what I mean? It's just I don't say. I mean, they certainly have a privileged position. If you look at, for example, like the intelligence positions in the Biden administration, right, and
Well,
percentage
yeah,
of.
Department of Homeland Security, the Treasury
I mean,
Department,
for
State
example, all this.
Department.
So they're using the American intelligence agencies as a way for basically Jewish control of the country.
Yeah.
It seems so straightforward.
Well, even the way the liberal society that they've done so well in, these Jewish billionaires you see with like Ackman and other Lauder, Soros isn't really an American, but you have other. Jewish billionaires who are now openly announcing they're going to cut off funding universities if they don't fire.
Yeah,
So
gay
they're,
is a terrific idea unless she's not anti, I mean, unless she doesn't oppose any sort of criticism of
And
Israel. Or,
by the way, and it's basically it's for her not responding to criticism of Israel, which is a foreign government with its own intelligence apparatus, military. But again, we see with the State Department being controlled by Jews, the CIA being controlled, largely controlled by Jews, the Treasury Department being controlled by Jews, the sanctions department has always been Jewish, that they're the ones that are able to impose sanctions on countries, is their narrow interests are being pursued at the expense of the country.
And it's obvious. Point out that their narrow self-interest, which is in opposition to the general public's interest, if you point out this is undemocratic, what is this? Well, this is anti-Semitism, right? This is somehow being portrayed as a general criticism of the Semitic people, right? I mean, it's just insane that the public would allow that phrase to have any meaning at this point. And hopefully it is starting to erode its propaganda power. You know,
well, I mean, when you mention things like Freemasonry, it was a real force in the 19th century. So much so there was an anti-Freemasonic party. People talked about it. And there was people, you know, I mean, this was his history. But nevertheless, in terms of 20th century, you run the risk of mystifying, over mystifying it. Meaning, was it just these guys hanging out at the Masonic temple on the weekends playing ping pong?
Uncle and Bubba, yeah, you know.
Yeah, you know. It was, you can see it because basically the United States, if you do the history of this, is the elite, the East Coast elite, which formed in the 19th century. There was always an aspiring oligarchy along the Eastern seaboard. And we saw even the early days of the, right after the Revolution, with Alexander Hamilton and his plan for the National Bank, controlled by financiers who were connected to the Bank of London. Things like the international slave trade, I talked about the intrigues in and around the so-called American Civil War. But you saw with the development, the Russell Trust, Yale University, the clipper ships, the opium trade, sort of these Americans who sort of insinuated themselves into this lucrative opium trade, and the development of the clipper ships, which could travel, was it three times as fast or something, make three visits to China? Yeah. So that was a sort of an example of technology sort of changing things. So you had this vast fortune developed around the opium trade, which, by the way, Yale University was endowed. The Yale was a guy who worked for the British East India Company, was engaged in the opium trade. That's the foundation. And you have the development of Skull and Bones, a secret society on the Yale campus. A handful, I think a dozen a year are selected, and these people would be selected. And these people were families like the Lodges,
Freemason was completely all through.
Yeah. So it's all very secretive, and all kind of enwrapped in sort of a degeneracy and also a ritual. And this is a psychological to get people, to identify to the group. And it's in many ways Luciferian satanic if you get into it, because it's again, and the, which is. It came out of the Illuminati, these things that in fact some of the rituals I think were borrowed from the Illuminati because Russell went over there in the 1830s or 40s and picked this up from Bavaria and brought it back and then incorporated into the Russell Trust and Skull and Bones. And Russell Trust was the finance of Skull and Bones. Now, Skull and Bones for the longest time would supply the cohort of the American intelligence elite foreign policy in the early 20th century. And then you had in the aftermath of the First World War, you had these families like the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds. They formed, I think in England, was the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and its analog in the United States was the Council of Foreign Relations. And these were the experts in foreign policy. At the time, the American government was relatively innocent and non-interventionist. So when the American government expanded greatly in the 1930s, 1940s, they provided the personnel for the foreign policy establishment. At the time, it was largely a WASP project. But there was always the WASP-Jewish alliance. And as I mentioned, as early as the First World War, you saw sort of Jewish power flex its muscle and manipulate U.S. foreign policy. And this, you see this in the 1930s and 40s with America's position with Germany. It became anti-German because of largely Jewish influence and also Anglo-American, the broader Anglo strategy of the Mackinder Doctrine in controlling affairs on the continent, preventing any major power from developing. In the 19th century, it switched from France to Germany. England became anti-German, whereas the 19th century was mostly anti-French because they saw French as the principal European power. And so as Germany developed, it became the Mackinder Doctrine was developed and Germany became the target. And you had the 30 Years' War, World War One and World War Two, and the destruction of German independent power on the continent after the Second World War. In the 1950s and 60s, you had sort of the WASP domination of foreign policy. You could say that immediately after the Second World War, the WASP sort of beat back the Morgenthau Jewish Zionist element, and the WASP took over. And you had the Korean, Dean Acheson, you had the Korean War and these things. But nevertheless, with the you had this sort of the growing Jewish power in the United States in the 1950s because of A, one thing, the expansion of media, Hollywood, electronic media, television, it was all Jewish operated and controlled. You know, C.D. Jackson, his real name was C.D. Jacobson. Time Life, although it was controlled by Henry Luce, a lot of Jews were involved in it. In the 1960s, it was slowly taken over and used for the purposes of Jewish power, particularly after 1967 and late 70s. You have sort of the demise of the WASP elite and the ascendancy of the Jews. So you had a sort of what's called a circulation of elites within the American power structure. You had a sort of a quiet revolution, and you were also Jewish cultural ascendancy because they're able to exploit America's liberal system. A lot of Jewish agitation in the law. They're good at this, at least a cohort of them are, and they use sort of litigation and legal agitation to do away with what local rule. The 14th, we talk about the 14th Amendment, at least its interpretation of the 14th Amendment, the destruction of local anti-obscenity laws, the application of the First Amendment to obscenity, pornography, and also with electronic media, with the culture war, to promote a popular culture which promoted degeneracy and sort of atomization of society under the cover of integration, the smashing of ethnic neighborhoods, the rise of suburbia, economic developments. Like one thing is the extension of credit, inflation, going into debt, consumerism. All these things play into this, and that's why it's so difficult to understand. Sort of the distorting and retardation of American society and the American economy all transformed America from a broadly Christian Protestant nation in 1900 to a broadly a Judaic nation 19, in culturally in by the year 2000. Well, probably by 1970, but it was completed by 2000, and you get the war on terror and the Iraq war. And when you have overt Jewish domination, the neoconservatives, all the intrigues that led to the Iraq invasion, exploiting all the hysteria of 2001 and these things. So it's kind of like, oh, wow, where we're going about our affairs, raising our family, trying to get an education, pay our bills, and these schemers are taking over US foreign policy and bankrupting the country and destroying its reputation.
And it was to be expected because I think they've obviously been in the background and certainly have had the majority of our political power since the beginning of the creation of the country. And we get bamboozled by the terms that they identify themselves with. You can see it, first of all, from like the Knights Templar going back. Well, what that name, I mean, like what is the actual origin and ethnic composition and purpose of the group? The group then morphs into Freemasonry, right? It changes its name after it's being attacked, by Catholicism. De Molay is burned, in the steps leading up to Notre Dame. But then it changes its name. It becomes Freemasonry. And you go forward, you can see, well, you have like Skull and Bones and Bohemian Grove, right? These are, you can just see from the political kind of like manifestations of the organization and financial manifestations
Well,
that the
it's at Skull and Bones, and there are various get-togethers in their island up there, and where the island ever was it what's that island called again?
Oh yeah, forget it. But
Deer
anyway,
Island? Deer Island?
I forget. Anyway, but my
And also, my point is there, and also in Bohemian Grove, where foreign policy decisions are made, and it's not made in Congress or in committee
listen,
hearings
I
or
mean
came,
the
you know,
atomic
or the
bomb,
National Security Council for that matter.
right? But Bohemian Grove was the organization that decided to develop the atomic bomb, something in fact which they now brag about openly. But what I was saying was is that these organizations are no longer functioning in that form. I mean, they're turning into basically Bohemian Grove is becoming like a dinner society,
Yeah, I mean, when they created CIA in 1947, that was sort of a consummation of this untoward between the state and these sort of secret interests. So you didn't have to sort of formalize, same way it was formalized with the creation of Israel.
Exactly right. So they're transitioning from like kind of extra government controlled secret societies to just overt secret societies inside of government, like the CIA and the FBI.
So are they secret societies anymore? They're open secret societies?
But the whole government is a secret society at this point. But
well, now because of secrecy laws, which you don't have, by the way, but because of the Byzantine national security state is effectively a secret society because there's no effective oversight or public accountability. Yeah. Good example is Biden just launches a war against the Houthis and there's no like congressional inquiry or even a request for a declaration of war. Presidents can just launch unilaterally, start these wars now in the name of protecting commerce.
Yeah, I mean the democratic aspect of our government is lost.
That started in 1950 with Korea, yeah, right?
We have kind of a dictatorship now. The president just does whatever he wants.
Yeah, I think the last time the United States government declared war was 1942, I think, against Romania.
Yeah, that was a good one. But anyway,
so basically, if that's the case, we've been at peace since 1942.
Right, in a wonderful period. But the point is that the public is confused by the changing of the names. You change from, the Masons to Bohemian Grove. Suddenly,
how about the War Department to the Department of Defense?
Exactly. So they are constantly changing the referent because they know that in the minds of the public, they would see something different and new, and then they don't get focused upon, what is in back of these agencies because they keep changing their names all the time. Mm-hmm. The public needs to start thinking about the long-standing application of this hidden hand that controls our foreign policy. I mean, mm-hmm. that's why I always, I try to take the broadest possible context in describing these things, going back, to the Revolutionary War and then looking at the Vietnam War as another example of it. It's inexplicable as a kind of coherent foreign policy. It doesn't have any real, there's no a reason that the U.S. was threatened by, the Viet Minh or something like this. It's just, these are ludicrous ideas, but there's this idea of depopulation and the idea of psychological traumatization, because that's another one of our, the aspects of the hidden hand is that they traumatize the individuals or move them into, emotional and psychological cul-de-sacs like, the youth culture and the communes with LSD on one hand and the people fighting in the Vietnam jungle on the other. I mean, this is traumatizing the generation. Generation isn't going to be able to really stand up against, the oligarch control of government because it has its own individual personal problems it's got to be dealing with. I was there. I saw all this. So this is the thing that I would hope is like one of the first steps is just to realize that they change the names of the organizations, but we always have to bring the same wisdom, which is to say our experience, our understanding of how the foreign policy has been manipulated from the very beginning to the current situations, to, the business with the Houthis, mm-hmm. for God's sake. What is the U.S., if we start engaging in warfare with them, is this really in the interest of the public, to actually stop the Houthis from being, a political power? I mean, we have to always think about the hidden hand,
Why these wars are being prosecuted. Like, good example is, say, the 1973 Yom Kippur War. Now, you can have the Israelis, they're supposedly attacked or caught by surprise by the Egyptians and the other Arab states. And the Nixon administration, with Kissinger whispering into his ear, comes to the aid of Israel and barrels them out. But the war itself supposedly sparks the Arab oil embargo, which causes whether the Saudis or OPEC ever really independent of the Western powers, particularly the United States? I don't think so. They have no military power. Therefore, with no military power, you're not independent. That's just the way it is. So we have this whole narrative where this is a response, but this causes oil prices, the oil shocks to go up. I think the price of oil shoots up 400%. It's overnight makes several oil projects, particularly in Alaska and the North Sea, profitable for the oil companies. It also causes the energy crisis. It stops third world development in its tracks. and causes them to go into debt, which eventually causes the third world debt crisis, which is used as sort of that economic model to further impoverish the third world, keep it from developing because it was perceived as a threat to Western domination, particularly a continued Western domination on the planet, because they didn't want the third world to develop on its own. And so in 1973, were the Israelis being used for that, or were they part of it? Because there was, I think it was that plan was actually proposed at the 1972 Bilderberg meeting. At least that's what's reported in Sweden that year. They needed an oil crisis or a crisis to cause the oil prices to go up 400%. This again sparks the inflationary 70s, or leads it contributes to great, because this that was kind of a hangover from the 60s. But the idea of the oil sharks creates the petrodollar. And this is 2 years after Nixon severs the tie for gold with the Bretton Woods system that had been put in place in 1944. So, I mean, again, was this all planned out, or
Of
just
course
one
it
thing
was.
after
And
another? I mean,
obviously, you have Bretton Woods, and then you have the creation of the petrodollar. The idea that this is somehow just an organic process is just too far-fetched to really seriously consider. Of course, it's all planned out. They could see they didn't have enough gold on hand to use currency and money in the kind of international financialization system that they wanted to. And also, they could see that. Gold, of course, is basically a means of exchange that the public can control. They didn't want that, so the petrodollar was developed. The 6 Day War was obviously manipulated from the very beginning. I mean, you can see that. A simple way to see that, in my mind, is just to look at following World War I, when Hussein was concerned about the acceleration of Jewish influence and control over Palestine. And he complained to Churchill, and Churchill told him at that time, "I will set the Saudi family against you." I mean, he literally made the declaration that they controlled, as a military operation, the Saudis, right? And this is like in the 1920s. So they had this kind of hidden hand control in back of the region. They set up these little splinter states instead of a united Arab country for the purpose of being able to create these antagonisms. And then they manipulated them in that instance to create this stupid situation against Israel, which, the idea that they really had any serious chance of success, I think, is very far-fetched. I think that it's a template that then was reused here on October the 7th, where you have the Palestinians representing, the Egyptians and attacking Israel. But it's all done just for in this instance, the depopulation of
Well,
Gaza.
now it's obviously ethnically cleansing they're doing there.
Yeah, just outright raw
I
ethnic.
think it meets the effect what the Israelis are doing with your support. It meets the UN convention against genocide and ethnic cleansing. It meets the definition. U.S. and Israel are both parties to that treaty, so they're in violation of the treaty they signed by supporting this policy.
Yeah,
But
and
the
of course
question is that
now.
you get these wider conflicts, like whether it's this expanding is what appears to be expanding conflict. Potentially a war with Iran or in the Ukraine is you have the war, then the war creates scarcity and economic turmoil. Is the objective of the war itself or the economic turmoil the pretext for to change out
Right.
of chaos a new order? Because you get that looking at the evidence in 73, the evidence particularly with 2022 with the fomented war in Ukraine with the U.S. foreign policy. Was obviously instigating a crisis because it was constantly pressuring, expanding eastward towards Russia's borders. Expand NATO expand. You can't have a defensive alliance if it's constantly expanding. By definition, it's no longer a defensive
Right.
alliance. I mean, that's just simple logic. I'm sorry.
Well, and also you
That's the,
can't
if you,
have.
that's your definition of defense. By the way, it's very similar to the Israeli definition of defense, which is constantly expanding borders. Why do you always have enemies? Because your borders are always expanding.
Yeah, and then of course you can't have completely irrational like pretexts for the antagonism against Russia, like the violation of the Minsk agreements. I mean, the fact is they were permitting the attacks on the ethnic Russians. They could have stopped them in a heartbeat. And just consider, Tim, how much easier would it have been to stop these kind of paramilitary, national Ukrainian organizations like the Azov Battalion? How much easier would it have been to have stopped that than to try to fight Russia, right? How much easier would it, and how many fewer casualties would the Ukrainians have experienced?
Well, the objective was to foment a war.
Of course it was.
I mean, Lloyd Austin, our esteemed defense secretary, actually said that. He said, whatever the result of this war, we've achieved our objective, which is weakening Russia. Actually, they haven't achieved that.
Which is ludicrous. This is a pretext which cannot be seen as legitimate, because you cannot, at least in terms of it being a legitimate, defense or something that promotes Ukrainian interest, because you can't use a nation that's one tenth the size to engage in a war of attrition with the other nation. I mean, you're obviously going to run out of people before the other one does, and so the war of attrition is working against you, which is exactly what's happening. This is just another stupid excuse for genocide.
But if you don't support this, Joe, you are an isolationist.
I am an isolationist in the extreme. And you know, the thing is that what all of this means, everything we have discussed, is that we just don't have any real control over our political system. And this is the darn problem, is that they've been able to get in and manipulate the public to believe that there was some kind of legitimate democracy going on. And then they control the individuals who get put in. And that's why, going full circle here, the protest in Germany is so encouraging to me, because it actually has the right target. I'm sure there are 100 things of confusion inside the rebellion, the protest. But in general, it understands at this point that the political class is against the German people. And what we have to do is remove the political class. This is what we have to do in the United States. You know, mm-hmm. you can't continue this Democrat Republican revolving uni-party, circus, where you have your choice between, Doug Christie and Kamala Harris. Mm-hmm. This is ridiculous. It's just going to constantly produce results that are, going to just keep weakening and impoverishing and murdering the American public. You got to replace the whole political class. This they have to be put under a microscope by the public. There has to, and this is really, if you think about it, really, what is the independent media? What does it do? What is its ultimate, logos? And that's what it is. It's here to scrutinize the government and create skepticism about government declarations of what history is. And that will continue until the public gets enough understanding that it is able and willing to act against the government en masse, that it can see, this government is just a pack of lies. That's all it is, just a pack of lies and propaganda, and we can't look to any member of it. If you're inside that entity, you are, even if you are not dirty and part of them, you're simply too conditioned or too stupid to be useful. You've got to remove the entire thing. You just have to take it completely out and replace it with, people from local areas in the United States, what we need to do is to end federalism, which is a big task, but we just got to constantly move sovereignty back to local areas, smaller and smaller, to give more and more power to the smaller sovereignties. And that's really the process that the independent media ultimately will achieve, in my opinion, is that we're going to expose the political class as a secret society and genocidal to the interests of the public. And then therefore we will start moving political power down till we get to the point where we are actually engaged in activities described in our Constitution, which is very clear about, powers that are not described inside this little document, who controls them. The states will start having control, and then, of course, counties and cities, which is one of the reasons why I think they can see this effect. The secret society can obviously see this going on. So one of the solutions is to end the democratic process by bringing millions of people
Yes.
across the borders who aren't, you know, don't have the mental skills to understand U.S. politics, and will just vote the way that they're
told. Not going to question that. Yeah, it's like, yeah. They won't question. They'll allow the corruption, the high level corruption. That's the strategy that worked in California, and they wanted to work.
Yeah, they'll be just grateful to have to be here and be on the welfare system. That's how far as they're concerned. That's an upgrade from their impoverished conditions in Central America, which they are impoverished because this is a deliberate program.
Well, the difference is in America, the traditional Americans had at least the understanding that they expect some response from their government, whereas where the country they come through, they don't expect anything.
they expect is bad, you know.
So, you know, but a good example of how bad it is if you look at what's going on, like in Gaza, and the ethnic cleansing, the savage bombing of unarmed, helpless civilians. People know this is going on, and the public knows this is going on. But if you poll the political class, there's virtual unanimous support for Israel. What does that tell you?
Exactly. I mean, the fact that it isn't even like discussed or any kind of nuance applied to this thing, this could only occur if there is a complete control by the hidden hand of the political class. This just shows you what we're fighting against. It really defines it in very stark contrast. This is
the problem. Lack of debate means it undermines the legitimacy of the political class because it's obvious.
Sure. Just like the vaccine mandates and the lockdown did.
If they were smart, they'd orchestrate a 55-45 division, and so we have the appearance of division. But they're not that smart. They want unanimity. They want unanimous support. You know, there's one congressman on Capitol Hill which criticizes AIPAC and the Israeli lobby, calls it Israel. They'll work to primary them out. They'll deprive funding to them because the handful of Congress critters that oppose this, they'll work day and night to get them out of Congress because that's how obsessed they are with control.
But you know that, as I've said, the reason for this is actually kind of shows that there's a light at the end of the tunnel here, because they can't engage in any debate now without diminishing returns. They cannot. They just can't go anywhere.
Maybe that's why they're building tunnels now.
Well, come to think of it. I mean, yeah, the tunnels, that's kind of funny. We'll have to talk about that at some point. But the thing is that to have a discussion with, no matter how they construct it, with the idea of like, well, we're going to we're going to get our propaganda, you know, we'll get anti-Semitism, Holocaust denial, conspiracy. We're going to get these concepts more infirm, you know, in their minds. Mm-hmm. They can't do it. It's impossible. Whenever they talk about, they produce more rebellion than control. Yeah. This is what I'm saying. And so they can't talk at all. They have to just basically remove people being like gay or even, you know, the concerned about the Gazan people being genocide. You can't talk about it. They're leaving reality to the independent media. All they can engage in now is just this, kind of artificial world with that doesn't permit any discussion of anything. Mm-hmm. So they should be, in my opinion, it's pretty easy pickings, you know, intellectually here. They're defenseless at this point from just a Socratic.
Well, that's funny. Is you talk about, Operation Prosperity Guardian, where, you know, Israel, America's going to engage in a war to keep the sea lanes open, the flow of commerce. And that sounds all nice and good. But listen, if the cost of globalism, the cost of deindustrialization, exporting our manufacturing and spreading it throughout the world so they can exploit the cheap labor in Asia or Africa, or not Africa, but, you know, South America, whatever. If that's the in China and these things, if the cost of that is constant warfare, because you have all these choke points in trade that can be disrupted by a band of, basically Muslim hillbillies, then perhaps you shouldn't have a globalist system. You should, direct your manufacturing domestic to keep it secure and stable, as opposed to these highly caught, these very expensive sea lanes. They're tenuous, they're long distance, and any disruption in them can cause an economic crisis. Then perhaps you should again reshore your industry.
And that's a great analogy for the political system.
Yeah,
you know, you can't have this global, like, federalism is becoming globalism. When it becomes globalism, it's so fragile. Any little thing, well, fragile in the sense that you get depopulation of with any little breakdown of anything.
And is there any little pretext for to start a war?
Yeah, of course. And the solution is just to reverse this, to start moving political power down toward the people again, which isn't going to happen, unfortunately, unless the people reach up and grab it. Mm-hmm. They will never, ever, ever let any of us have any political power that they can prevent, because they are obsessed with control, and they have to maintain it at this point. Because if, I mean, just as an example, if the understanding, just the discussions that we've had here in our show, if this becomes part of the public lexicon, where can the oligarchs hide, right? I mean, where can they hide from the crimes of World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War? I know people mm-hmm. are still traumatized by that. You know, the everything that they have done, basically, in the as a political class, has been to destroy and damage and weaken the interests of the American public they were supposed to be representing. So they are traitors, and they have nowhere to hide if this gets, you know, it kind of becomes just the common world. And so they have to do everything they can to keep the discussion from occurring, which is why, you know, you get this bizarre situation like today here in California, where you have Central Europe with one of the largest, if not the largest, protests in history. Because, you know, what I'm learning about, they're coming in from all other countries now. Mm-hmm. They're coming across the border. And it's spreading out into little towns. I mean, this is really a very, very real and serious political reaction. Yet they cannot talk about it in California. It's not something that can be discussed.
What's going to happen is some clown's going to show up and like do the Nazi salute.
They'll try to characterize it as like white ring extremism, but again, diminishing returns. I just don't think they can sell that story, and I think that they can't talk about it, because if they did, where does it lead? Right? What does it mean if they get into there's deliberate depopulation that seems to be occurring in terms of our farm regulations, right? Well, what does that do in terms of looking at the vaccine mandates? Does that do in terms of looking at the foreign policy in Gaza? Suddenly, everything becomes exposed.
Well, how do you sell to Germans or even just Americans that a consequence of U.S. intervention and meddling in the Russo-Ukrainian conflict is the destruction of Germany? Boy, that's a... Is that really a real?
Is that a good idea?
Well, it is if you want to depopulate, I guess.
Yeah, is this a good idea? Are you really thinking clearly? But of course not. And in fact, that's the pretext is irrational, and this is what exposes the hidden hand.
Well, realistic foreign policy would say, okay, Ukraine is on Russia's doorstep. It's in the shadow of Russia. It's always going to be in the sphere of Russia's interest. And we negotiate on those terms. No, no, no. We have to fight for democracy and, you know, what that broad term democracy means is just global homo perversion degeneracy.
Well, and in the Ukraine, it means a dictatorship, because they haven't had an election. Nor will they ever have one, because the public could kick this guy out in a second. If you want to know about democracy in the Ukraine, ask Gonzalo Lira.
Yeah.
Except you can't, because he's dead. You know, that's a shame. Because
is that confirmed?
Citizen who was taken.
Is that confirmed now?
Yeah.
When did you hear that he died?
Yesterday.
I didn't hear about that. Wow.
His father confirmed it this morning. Yeah.
So he died in captivity.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
And the U.S. State Department said nothing.
It said absolutely nothing, and they can't.
Nothing. He's a U.S. citizen, by the way, and he was murdered just for speaking his mind.
Yeah, I mean, if you go through point by point everything that he was saying, there is nothing that the U.S. should not have been willing to stand to protect him on the basis of the
at least tell them to expel him.
Of course,
and he'll come back to the United States or Chile, whatever.
He died, and again, this, you know, it kind of fits into the concept of our show about the foreign policy, because this is an aspect of foreign policy.
Yeah,
and this is an aspect in which they create death because they will not permit discussion. Lyra could not be brought back here, because he would just be something that would, add to the skepticism and understanding of the actual genocide intention of the Ukrainian war.
Yeah,
right.
His crime was just talking about what he was witnessing.
100%. So anyway, this is, in the old days, before the independent media, this would have, they would have happened, and it wouldn't have meant anything. But now it does. Now, you know, the, you know, his death adds to the fire of the growing understanding and rebellion against the political class, the corrupt, organized secret society, which is in the control of a hidden hand and has pretexts and lies to us about, you know, this purported democracy that we get to participate in, you know? So anyway, it's like, it's sad, but it's very illustrative of all of the things you've been saying. I was thinking about when you were talking about it, going, yeah, you know, Tim is, he's actually creating kind of the, both the prelogue and epilogue for Gonzalo, you know? I mean, it's a, you know, sad to say.
Yeah. Okay, Joe.
All right, brother. Well, thanks for the discussion. We'll get them next week.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.